You're listening to the Geekscape Network.
Time to fire up the VCR. This one's my favorite.
Welcome to Analog Jones and the Temple of Film. I'm Steve, and this is the VHS podcast. We're not talking about the box art trailer and behind the scenes. We're actually interviewing a special guest here. So Brad and Chris, say hello to Taylor, and then Taylor, you say hello back.
Hi, Taylor. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Taylor.
Hello, Brad and Chris and Steven.
We got you on here on Geekscape, and we wanted to help you promote your new film that you got going up. Well, you'll have an Indiegogo on March 4th. And it's called Vampire, and I read it was a horror comedy.
It is a horror comedy. It is part live action, part cartoon. Think Evil Dead 2 meets Who Framed Roger Rabbit. It is mostly done filming, but the animation is all yet to be done, and we're trying to raise some money so that we can actually finish this weird indie horror thing that may or may not be based on Bambi, because some things are in the public domain, and everybody's making their horror movies based on some stuff that's in the horror public domain these days. It's kind of a cartoon, just any gimmick I could find to throw at the wall because to break through the noise of the 400,000 indie horror movies that are coming out this year. That's what we did.
I've always wondered when it comes to the public domain. Now, when you drop a trailer for this, does it have to be past the mark of when the public domain stops?
For the trailer? It depends on what's in the trailer, I think.
All right.
We're not lawyers here, Steve.
No, I'm not lawyers, too.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, Bambi entered the public domain last year, so it's not... We're not...
Oh, you're good, then. Forget it.
Yeah. So we can do whatever we want, except have a cartoon deer that looks like the Disney one, and it's the book of Bambi that's in the public domain, so we can't have, like, a rabbit named Thumper or anything. So we've got someone named Bambi, but it's probably a stripper.
Nice. This movie's sounding better and better as we go.
Nice.
Yeah, this is going to be fun. Now, with the animation, I guess putting together the storyboards was probably the hardest part coming over this, because you got to figure out how to place the actors and then the animation, but you're doing them both at separate times.
Right. And that's why we had to film it, basically all of it, before we could start the animation, because it's mixed media, so the animator's drawing over the actual frames. Yeah, the storyboards were super key because I would make storyboards and we'd have them on set and we'd go and be like, okay, this is, you know, you're acting and maybe we have a teddy bear here for you to act against, but maybe you just got to imagine a cartoon animal, because most of the cartoons are for the animals, because I couldn't figure out how to get a deer or a raccoon or a bear to do what I wanted it to do. As a director, it's very challenging. Never work with children or animals. And we had both, but they're cartoons.
Yeah, how was the reactions from the actors, the little teddy bears and everything like that?
I mean, I think for the most part, they get it. There's not a ton of scenes. It's a lot of, like, point at something, you know, like, oh, you're looking, somebody go stand where they need to look, and you're just out of frame, and they're looking at whatever the animal is. So it's, I mean, I don't know. It's an indie, low-budget movie. We tried our very best. It's hard to do this stuff.
You look at some of those new Marvel films and it's an actor and then green.
Yeah.
Everything's green and they're looking at tennis balls that are green. They're just X's on stuff. It's like, that's got to be impossible.
Yeah. And when you're trying to keep it in your head, you know, as a director, you're like, I think I'm looking at my storyboards. I'm looking up. It's obviously missing the biggest thing in the storyboard because that has to be drawn in later. So you're like, I think this is going to work. I hope this is good. I mean,
they can animate it where it needs to be.
Yeah, they can fix it, not fix it in post, but it's like, you know, it's pretty badass, I think, that there's cartoons in it. And if it's not like exactly perfectly where it needs to be, it's still badass. It's still, still an indie horror movie with cartoons in it.
One thing that impresses me about all, you know, filmmaking and directorial aspects is just how long was this percolating your mind? And then how long have you been thinking about like some topic like this or some?
This was brought to me. So the writer and producer is a friend of mine. Her name is Zoe. She's from Alaska. She's real into the nature versus man dynamic. And she brought me this script 2 years ago. It was called something else, and it was just like a deer horror movie. And I was like, well, wait a minute. 2 years ago, Bambi was not in the public domain, but that sort of was coming up. I'm like, what if we rewrote this to be more of a Bambi flick? And then we're like, great, this is a great movie. And we looked at it and we're like, but how are we going to get the deer to do what we want? And it took like 6 months to come up with the cartoon idea. We were looking at puppets, and that was going to be crazy expensive because there's a lot of animals. And we just sort of eased our way into what this became. But it's been almost a 2-year process to get to this point. And we're still, the animation has just started, and we still have some more stuff to film for the live action. So it'll be like a 3-year process overall.
Yeah, at least you didn't do Milo and Otis and just kill a bunch of animals on set. Like, animation is probably the best route.
Yeah. You don't want to go the Milo and Otis route.
I'm impressed that you, like, a 3-year commitment for a film like that is just like, you know, I mean, because it's, you could just go off and do an indie horror film, you know, in the woods, a cabin in the woods type thing. But I think it's incredibly impressive that you're like, not only am I not going to do that, I'm going to go way out of my way to, you know, use animation and actors and do all this crazy stuff. And a 3-year commitment. I mean, that's impressive.
Yeah, it's got to be great planning, too.
It also takes longer when you don't have money. That's something mm-hmm. else I've learned, you know, because I've done a bunch of documentaries. This is my first narrative scripted feature. The more money you have, the faster these things go, typically. You know, you still look at Marvel, and they takes them 5 years to do anything, but that's more of a logistics problem than a money problem. But in the indie world, yeah, you could crank something out in 2 weeks if you had plenty of money to pay everybody to show up and do all this stuff. But when you're calling in favors and like just really trying to figure out how to make something happen, you stretch it out to when people are available and how you can pull things off without a lot of resources. So it doesn't always have to take 3 years.
I imagine, you know, trying to get a shooting schedule up with all these actors is difficult too, because with a documentary, you're traveling, you know, like when you did your Scob one, you know, you probably interviewed a couple bands at a time. With this one, it's just like, all right, we got to start at 6 a.m. and do that. What was the challenge beyond that since jumping from documentaries?
Yeah, I was just talking with another filmmaker this morning about that. Documentaries, I used to think making a documentary was really hard. Because it also, you know, some of these movies take me 3 or 4 years, but that's like shooting 2 interviews and waiting 4 months and shooting 2 more and, you know, waiting a few months around people's schedules. Because I do pop culture docs and you're like trying to get celebrities to be in your movie. And they're like, yeah, sure, I can do it June 12th. And you're like, it's January. Okay, I guess the movie's taking 6 months longer. But with a scripted thing, you know, we've got 7-8 actors in the same scene. And most of them, I live in Oregon, and we were flying people in from all over. You know, we had some cool, like, LA folks, people you've heard of in movies you've seen, flying in. And you're just like, we got 1 day to do this. If this doesn't work, you know, on the day when we're 8 people on set, some of them we're never going to have again. Like, it's a lot harder. Also, a documentary, like, if it doesn't go great, that's part of the movie, you know?
I mean, that's some real we are the world pressure right there.
Right. But that's true for all movies. Like, you know, I learned a lot trying to make this because I watch a ton of movies and I judge movies. And now I have this newfound appreciation for, like, if anyone can finish a movie and just make a movie that exists, man, good for them. That was hard to do. Like, it's way harder than I thought. Which is weird because I've made movies, but they're all documentaries. And I just figured going into this, like, oh, I could do that. That's so much shorter. You just shoot for 2 weeks and then hand it off to an animator or whatever. It ain't that. It's way harder.
Yeah, I've heard about the, like, panic attacks that some directors have when you're like, well, I got this actor for 10 hours and our setup just took 3. And then they're like, oh, no, how are we going to get this done in time? I've heard about that. And I mean, did you have anything like that at all?
100%. We had so Greg Sestero from The Room is in our movie, and we only had him for 1 day, and he got in. We were supposed to shoot his scenes at like 8 p.m. as a night shoot. I don't think we got him in front of a camera until like 2 a.m. and we just kept going until 6 a.m. And the poor man, like, kudos to him and supporting independent film and being like, sure, I'll stick this out and we'll get it. And we got it. But like, you get behind every time you try to shoot a film. It's inevitable. Something goes wrong, or setting this one light up takes longer than you thought, or whatever. Or the, you know, it takes 7 takes to get this one shot and you thought it was only going to take one. So it always ends up going behind, but you try to build that into the schedule. And then when you have people showing up for like one night shoot, just sitting around for 5 hours waiting for their scene because everything is falling apart. And it was, I think, pouring rain. We couldn't set up, I think one of the lights wasn't working because it kept getting wet and shorting out. And like, it's the stuff, you know, like you hear about the T-Rex getting too wet and it would shake and do all that. But they had $200 million to fix that problem. And we had $2 to fix ours.
We need more trash bags right now.
There's a lot of trash bags.
It's like a lot of entrepreneurial spirit there where you're kind of assembling the airplane after you go off the cliff with it, it seems like.
100%. That's what indie film is. You say, I'm going to make this movie. You start making the movie and you have no idea how you're going to get past. You know steps 1 and 2, and step 100 is there's a movie.
Yeah.
But step 33, I have no idea. And you're doing step 70 and you still don't know what step 33 was.
Yeah, and I can imagine a lot of people coming. I mean, because they're all coming to you, right? You're the director. Like, oh, we have a problem with this. Oh, we have a problem with that. I mean, I can't. How did you deal with that type of pressure with, you know, such a small budget film?
It's a lot of pressure because everything that goes wrong is your fault. And everything that goes right is like, oh, look how good the actors are. And look how great, what a great location we have. I can't believe it looks so good. I have crippling anxiety. That's how you deal with it.
There you go. Alcohol, drugs, whatever it takes.
100%. Yeah.
A lot of crying.
Right. If you want anxiety, go try to direct a movie.
There's no crying in baseball. Yeah.
All right. There you go.
It's rough, but I can't complain because, like, who doesn't want to make movies? I basically make movies for a living.
It's like, you know, being an athlete in a way, too, where it's like you have to be great, you know, and it's like if you're 90% as good as somebody who is up there, like, that's not going to get you there. You got to be great. And
well, I think just making it to the show is incredible. And like you were saying before, Taylor, just making a movie is kind of incredible. Just you completing it.
Have you seen some of the movies we've reviewed, Brad? I don't think everybody's got to be great. You just got to get to the finish line.
Most movies aren't great. I mean, I'm out here telling people I just saw Madam Web and it's barely a movie.
A few people say they've had fun.
And I had fun and I'm trying, you know, I wouldn't say anything bad about it. It technically counts as a movie.
I heard that the ADR is awful and it looks like it belongs on CW, which is a thing that I've been bitching about. Like, I love bad movies and shitty Marvel movies. I'm fine with, but now I'm like, why does this look like a soap opera in the 90s? Like, can you fix that?
It looks okay. I think there's certainly scenes in it that look cool or whatever. The ADR thing is wild. It's like if I handed in a movie, if somebody hired me to make a movie and I handed it in like that, I would be fired.
I will be watching it on the couch with my dog and cat, but not going to the theaters.
It's a fun time. It's a fun time. If you do it as a drinking game and every time their lips moving doesn't match what the dialogue is, you drink, you will die, but it will be really fun.
With the Indiegogo that you guys are putting together, is there like tiers with the donations?
Oh, yeah. Nah, I don't have it in front of me, but there's like the digital copy is lower and then we're doing Blu-rays and then there's a higher tier where you get your name in the credits. You get, we got t-shirts, we got hats that say Vampire. We got all kinds of stuff. And, you know, for the crazy money, you can be a producer and then you're part of the movie and you're helping us make the movie and I'll let you watch the early animation cuts and give me notes that I may or may not take. That's what producers do. So there's a whole spectrum and, you know, every dollar helps. You can go on to Indiegogo and give us a dollar and it'll say you get nothing, but I'll probably text you and be like, thank you. I appreciate your dollar because making movies is fucking hard and crazy expensive. And it sucks that this is how we have to make movies now with the crowdfunding thing. But like, I know a lot of independent filmmakers and this is just sort of the way. Because the studios aren't giving people money for different stuff, like cool ideas or interesting, weird sexy cartoon animals that are doing weird shit. Like, that's not a pitch that anyone's listening to. However, I like weird indie movies, and I think more of them should be made. So we just live in a world where, like, GoFundMe is a major healthcare provider and Indiegogo is a major film studio. That's just how it is now.
I will say something about the dollar, because some people won't do it. It's mm-hmm. you. I was told, like, think about it. If 1,000 people can only afford a dollar, that's still $1,000 on top of the 1,000 you wouldn't have got.
It's huge. And I appreciate it more as the kind of person, like, I don't have a lot of extra dollars, but I'll go on like Patreon or Kickstarter, Indiegogo, and support projects. If you're just like making a movie, I'm like, oh, cool. Let me give you a dollar. You don't need to send me the digital copy. You know, if you make it, great. I might remember and I'll watch it on Tubi or whatever when it comes out. That means more. Somebody who's just like, I want to support you. I don't have an extra $50 for a thing, but good job. Keep going. It's like a little, I don't know. It's just, as much as it's cool when somebody gives you $1,000, I feel like that person can afford that just as much as the person who gives you a dollar can afford a dollar. It's literally the thought that counts.
Can't move a mountain without starting with some pebbles. So
many hands makes for light work. And I think, you know, contributing to this, it makes it feel like a more intimate product. You see this and you're like, wow, that you have a connection to it at that point too. You're like, this is personal now. And
I gave that fucker a dollar. They bought a coffee with my money.
Hey, you know, we got to buy a lot of coffees to make movies. Yep.
It's true.
You're staying up till 6 a.m. You got
it. If you don't give us a dollar, we're paying for it ourselves, and then we have one less dollar. It's a weird system. The whole film industry is totally broken, but this is how we figured out to do it. I mean, I've crowdfunded most of my movies, and not only do people give you some money so you can pay for the lawyers and the insurance and all the stupid things that don't actually help the movie but cost a lot of money, but also you build a community of people who do feel like they're part of it. And they are part of it. I think that's pretty cool. We're making weird art stuff. Like, this isn't a mainstream thing. And so to have people who believe in it, that also shows, you know, the distributors and the streaming platforms, like, oh, there is an audience for this. Look at all these people who gave them a dollar. Like, the number of people who support it counts just as much as how much money did you raise. That's where the dollar people really help you. Because it's like, oh, 5,000 people gave them a dollar. That means 5,000 people would be interested in watching this.
Would go to the theaters or stream it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Our buddy Kyle funded his last two movies through Indiegogo.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah. So March 4th, everyone out there, give, if you want to be part of an indie culture, you know, with the horror film here and vampire, and you, if you can only afford a dollar, give a dollar.
Yeah.
I mean, why not? And look out for the packages. Indiegogo, March 4th, vampire.
And if you're under 18, you don't need your parents' permission either.
That's true. Get the executive producer perk. It's like $5,000. Do it.
Don't buy V-Bucks. Get a movie.
I know this is a VHS podcast, and I feel like I overlooked the coolest part of the movie, and what drew me to it from the very beginning is one of the characters. First off, the movie takes place in the 90s, and one of the characters is a film student who has a VHS camcorder on his shoulder for the whole time. So we have an in-world... like, it was running and we cut to it sometimes. So I got to shoot part of a feature film straight to tape, straight to VHS tape. Ah, it just feels cool to use the real technology. I had to track down working VHS camcorders. I had to order new batteries for them because the old ones are not holding up.
I own quite a few. And sometimes when you turn the new ones on, they smell like fire.
Yes.
For a bit. You're like, wow, that smells really bad. Should have cleaned that first.
And there was a very sad day on set, or like a heartbreaking moment, because the script called for the VHS camcorder to be destroyed. We had multiple. I still have multiple working VHS camcorders. But, oh, man, because you pick the, you know, the hero prop is the one that looks the coolest, obviously.
Yeah.
It is sadly no longer with us.
Well, find out what happened to that if you donate for Vampire and get a Blu-ray. Or will you be doing a VHS for this one?
We don't know yet. That's something we've talked about unlocking, you know, if there's enough interest, probably, because it's a pain in the ass. I've done VHS for two of my movies, and we did it. I just did an Indiegogo for my documentary about the TV show Lost that's mm-hmm. coming out this year. We did a VHS tier for that, and it sold out pretty quick. But that means I have to make by hand however many VHS tapes in real time. I don't have like a machine that makes a bunch. I have to record them
One more time, Indiegogo campaign for Bampire launches on March 4th. They've got tiers and everything. And then, hey, that $5,000 tier sounds pretty damn special. So if any of you, instead of like repairing something on your house, just help Taylor here.
Put that operation off for a while.
You never know. It's usually somebody who's like, oh, I found that in my couch cushions this morning. Must be fun to be you, but also thank you. And I appreciate it very, very much. Yeah, it's vampiremovie.com. We'll take you straight to the Indiegogo.
All right, now we'll get into talking a little bit of the last blockbuster, which...
I actually have the last blockbuster VHS. Give me one second. We made this before we finished the movie. Because if you've seen the movie, we hand it to everybody. Mm-hmm. So like Kevin mm-hmm. Smith has held this tape. And then when we finished the movie, I went back and recorded it onto the tape that's in here. So this is the one of one tape from the movie, but it looks a lot like the ones we put out. So
I thought that was really cool the first time I seen you hand it to them. I was like, that's fucking neat. You guys made that.
Because it's such a tactile thing. You know, people are like opening and closing it and picking at it and smelling it. And it was like, that's what happened to me when I walked in the store after not being in one for a decade and they had tapes. And I'm like, oh, the weight of it, the smell of it, the feel of it. I didn't collect tapes when I started making that movie. Got into VHS collecting because I made that movie.
Yeah, I'm a newer collector. I had a bunch before, like tons, and then I had to sell them and then got back into it about the same year.
Yeah, welcome to the awful club. You know, you'll be a victim for the rest of your life.
It's like working on cars, yeah.
Yeah, they got a lifespan.
It's not the expense or the inconvenience of it. It's that they take up so much physical space. Yeah.
That would be inconvenience.
I mean the inconvenience of watching them, because I watch tapes in my office. I have a TV hooked up to a VCR and I run them. That's my background noise, is just whatever I have on tape. But I've completely run out of room and I keep buying them. There's just stacks in the garage, don't fit my color scheme. So I don't know where to put them.
Yeah, I'm alphabetizing mine.
I got a question for you. How many VCRs you got?
Working or props?
Okay, there we go. Now we're getting to something.
I'll tell you, I have one working Laserdisc player.
Ooh,
that is good for you. That is my pride and joy. Yeah. And I've been through a lot of them that did not work.
There's a lot of cool Laserdiscs out there. I don't collect them, but there are some cool looking ones.
So you can really tell how far down the level of ridiculousness like you get. You ask people, how many VCRs do you have? I was like, well, I have three working. I have one that's a cleaner and then two broke. And you're like, all right, so you're six deep. All right.
I think those are my numbers. I'm not kidding. I think I have three working. And two, I have a top loader that's just to film. It's the one we used in the last blockbuster as a prop. Mm-hmm. It does not play tapes, but it physically feels good. I'll just put a tape in and load it and unload it and be like, this is great.
Yeah. I haven't found a top loader. I buy them if they're in stereo.
Yeah.
And that's my only requirement. If they're cheap and in stereo, I'm not spending $40 for a VCR.
Oh, I've never spent more than $10 on a VCR. Yeah.
Yeah. Prices are expensive right now, but once they drop back down, I'll start just binge buying again.
If they have a remote, that I think that is a lot for me.
That's worth it.
I've got two with working remotes, one in my office and one in the garage, and man, that's nice.
Yeah, this one has a remote that's hooked up to my computer.
I spend more on the remotes than I do on the VCR. I'm not shitting you. I got a $20 VCR that I really like. Nice combo. Mm-hmm. And I paid a guy $30 to program a remote. And I'm like,
wow,
what is wrong with me? But it's awesome. Yeah. It really is.
Pause and rewind without having to run up.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. It's wild. I do have a combo that is, it's the like late stage VHS DVD 20-inch flat screen CRT Ooh. Combo. It's great. And that's like my main, like if I just want to watch something conveniently, because it has a remote and it can play a DVD, it can play a VHS. I love it so much.
That's nice. That's real nice.
Yeah, I got to admit, your lineup that you got for the last blockbuster with, I mean, Kevin Smith and Adam Brody, Jamie Kennedy, I mean, Paul Scheer. How did you do that? Did you just reach out to him and get lucky?
Yeah, I mean, I'll be honest. That was my, at the time, second movie. My first movie, I got real lucky and Alice Cooper was in that movie. So I had like an IMDb with some street cred behind my name. And I was going into it and we would just cold, like I would DM people on Instagram or you know, find an email address that I hoped worked, or friend of a friend or whatever. We would send these cold messages like, hey, we're doing a documentary about Blockbuster Video, blah, 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 blah. And I'm pretty sure that most of those people just assumed we were a real company and had more money and were like a real movie. We may have implied that it was like an official Blockbuster documentary or something. I wouldn't have lied to people, but I do think that some people showed up and be like, oh, you guys just have like the little cameras and you're doing the thing. That's cute. Like, let's talk about tapes.
Yeah, I guess once you get them in the door, you're hoping like, well, maybe they just won't go, screw you guys, I'm out of here. I mean, they already blocked off time. Why not?
And it also, it snowballs, right? So if you get one name that people know, because I'm doing this one about Lost and we're trying to get the cast in it, and everybody's first question is, who else is in it? I think it was once we got Kevin Smith in it, everything else was just easy, because you write Adam Brody's manager and he's like, well, okay, who else is in it? And you're like, well, Paul Scheer and Kevin Smith and all these people that worked at Blockbuster. And he's like, oh, okay, I'll do it. And then they tell the next person Adam Brody's in it.
That's great.
And now it's easier, because now I can say I'm the guy who did the Blockbuster thing. And people are like, oh, you make real movies.
Yeah.
I've seen that, or I've heard of that. Everybody's at least heard of it. It made enough of a media splash where people are like, oh, I've heard of that. And then the DMs go a little bit easier than before, when I'm just like, I'm a guy in Oregon who owns a camera. Can I make a documentary with you in it?
I think the best interview you got was from Jared Rasick.
Yeah. We're still great, great friends.
I think that's one of the best scenes, is when he's explaining how he like would leave his house. And when you're like just using his voice as Sandy's voice and stuff, when she's talking to him, I love when that happens. I think that was fun. Something about that just feels really good.
Well, it's fun because neither one of them is an actor. I explained the concept to them, and it took a lot of takes for Sandy to like mouth along to Jared's voiceover, because she's just a lady who runs a Blockbuster, you know?
I do have a question with Sandy and them. Who did more interviews, you or Sandy, constantly talking to all these people, journalists and everything that were calling her?
She's done way more interviews than I have at this point. But when we started, they weren't the last story. I was the first person to ever interview Sandy, because showed up and there were still all these stores open, and she didn't understand why anybody would care.
What, you said 16 when you started or something?
12. There were 12 still in the world. And this one was just in my backyard. Like, I lived in that town, and I went in and it felt like such a vibe, and it smelled like a Blockbuster. And people, what blew my mind is there were like 15 people in there browsing for DVDs. And this was 2017 or whatever. And I did not understand what was happening. I was a huge Blockbuster customer, and then they closed in 2014, everybody knew it. I went to all the going out of business sales and bought tons of Blu-rays and video games for 15 cents, you know, 90% off, whatever. But I went in there and I was just like, this is fascinating. I must document this. Sandy, will you do an interview? And she didn't understand why anybody would want to talk to her. Cut to 2 years later, when they're the last store in the world, and she can't get any work done at the store because she's being interviewed on CNN and Good Morning America and all these crazy shows, and they all want to come to the store and interview her there because it's a landmark now.
Yeah, that's incredible. So this, like, you just started with like 12 stores. You had no idea that it would turn into this, and it just like snowballed into something that you're like, oh wow, this could be a full length documentary. Is that how it was? Or
yeah, I didn't know if it was going to be a short film or a feature or what when we were there. I just knew that I had to document it, because it was so weird. It was so unique to me. Like, it exists and there are still customers, and you know, like the things that are in the movie, when it hit me, like when I saw that they were still using these 90s IBM computers, they couldn't get new computers because they wouldn't run the software because Blockbuster doesn't exist and they can't get new software. And it's like the craziness of all that. And when Sandy showed me that she like physically repairs the computer, like she's a technician for these old computers. And when a store closes, they get all the computers, and she has a room full of skeletons of point of sale computers from Blockbusters. And it's just like that stuff I knew was a compelling story and fascinating for people who love renting movies, or just anyone who grew up going to Blockbuster, which is everyone, right? that's everyone. So we were in the right place at the right time in the fact that they became the last one, because we called the other 11 stores. Obviously, we were like, well, can we come? They were mostly in Alaska and Texas and Oregon. And we would try to raise enough money because we're indie filmmakers and be like, okay, it's going to cost us $3,000 to go to Alaska and film at these stores or something like that. And we would scrape together and we'd be like, all right, we've got $1,000 and now we've got $2,000, and we'd get almost there and we'd call the store and they'd be like, oh no, we closed last week. You missed it. And that just kept happening until there was only one left. So we never actually made it to a second store because by the time we could figure out how to get there, they were closed.
It saved you some money.
It did. It did save us some money. That's a great point. But also it ended up not being the story, because the story was about Sandy and this one lone store that stuck it out, and they're still open.
Yeah.
It's wild.
It worked out better in your favor having just one. Sandy seems like a wonderful woman.
She is.
And it was nice to probably follow her around.
I was impressed how much of a star she turned into in the documentary. Like when you're watching it, I was just like, this lady's really good in front of the camera. She's got a lot of camera charisma. And I'm like, she's just the star of the whole thing.
And that's just how she is in real life. She's just this lovable, like everybody wishes she was their mom. She's just great. And that's the best part of making these documentaries. Like I got to spend years hanging out with her, and she's still, you know, she'll call me out of the blue and look, we chat. Like, it's just great. It's great. She'll be like, I'm going to a Comic-Con and they're setting up a Blockbuster booth. What should I bring DVDs? What do I do? And, you know, and I've been on panels with her at cons and stuff, and it's great because she's the real deal. Like what you see in the movie is how she really is.
Sandy, you got to get a bunch of tapes and then sell them and then sign them, because I guarantee you someone would pay to get Sandy's signature on the last Blockbuster.
And she just needs to do commons. Just like, the last Blockbuster movie?
You know, you're the last Blockbuster, you're the last manager. Okay, yeah. I guarantee it. Now, if she had the last Blockbuster, yeah, people would sign that, definitely.
Yeah. Give her a stack of the Blockbuster original films?
Yeah, they started carrying VHS like 3 years ago because people kept asking. People kept coming in and being like, and they had switched to DVD. They don't really have Blu-ray. Like, they just live in this 2008 to 2012.
Yeah, you can see some of them when you pan. It'll be like a bay of just DVDs, and then you see that little blue one.
They do it based on supply and demand. So they'll buy 50 copies of Captain Marvel or whatever, and they'll buy like 5 Blu-rays, and that's about the ratio. It's like 10 to 1. The customers just have DVD players, and they don't know if the machine will play a Blu-ray, and they don't, you know, they're older, and they just go in and they rent a DVD and they know it works.
I love that she goes to Target to buy movies that she doesn't have. Something about that feels illegal to me.
Well, they used to. That happened. It didn't make it into the movie, but that was a subplot, is that there were these distributors that they would get all their movies through that would, you know, not just them, but every Blockbuster and every Hollywood Video and all these mom and pop stores. You can go in a catalog and you can say, I need 20 copies of this and 15 copies of that. And sometimes they get a discount or whatever. And the distributors would come and drop off a big box of movies. And that company went out of business while we were making our documentary. Oh, wow. So now there is no, for a while, I think Disney, so like Marvel and Star Wars, were the only company that you could still do that with. And that stopped happening while we were doing the documentary. So sometime between 2017 and 2020, there were no more. And so Sandy was just like, well, I guess I got to go to Target. And they know her at those stores, which is really funny because, you know, you're not supposed to buy 10 copies of the same movie. That's shady. They know what you're doing. Like, you're not, no human just needs 10 copies of, you know, the new Matrix movie.
Hey, you don't tell me my business, bud.
Right. But they know who she is. Yeah. You know, she's Sandy from Blockbuster. So she'll go in and she has relationships, and she'll be like, okay, you can buy 4 here. Now you got to go across the street to Walmart and buy your other 4 tapes, and you're not tapes, discs. And it's just hilarious when customers come in, and I do love this about that store. They'll come in and they'll request a movie that she doesn't have. And it'll be an old movie that you can't go to Target and get. And she goes on Amazon and she buys the movie. And then it rents one time. They just lose $15 because they buy some obscure movie because some customer wants it. and then rent it to that customer, and then it sits on the shelf and they sell it as previously viewed, and they just lose money because
the same person buys it.
Yeah. Yeah, probably.
He's like, well, it's cheap now.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's got kind of that heart of gold where you're kind of like, if you were a business person, being like, I'm not spending $20 on some, I don't know, like Buku DVD that one person will rent. But she's like, but they asked for it.
Part of owning a business and running a business is creating value for your customers, too. And she goes out of her way to do that for people. She's not just trying to nickel and dime you and squeeze everything she can from people.
No, not at all. And at the same time, you know, she buys these DVDs for people and they can rent them for 99 cents. Still, you can rent movies for 99 cents there, which is wild to me because supply and demand and how that stuff works. Mm-hmm. But they're still, you know, they're making a lot of money off of t-shirts and sweatshirts and
the hat she knits,
coffee cups and everything that says Blockbuster on it, because they're like the only retail store in the world for some of this stuff. And it became, once the movie came out, once the documentary came out, it became like this tourist location. Like people come, hundreds of people every month.
Absolutely. Yeah. I used to do business out in Ashland, Oregon. And I'm like, if I ever go out there again, I'm getting a rental car and I'm going out to Bend.
100%. And you should. And it's worth it is the thing. Like people are like, should I really? And people have flown there from all over the world. But if you're on a road trip up and down the West Coast, go to it, because it's not going to be there forever. And it is the last standing bastion of DVD rentals.
I mean, for a lot of us, people my age, I remember like going to Blockbuster every weekend. Like, and you know, this brought back all the nostalgia, like everything we were talking about, that brought it all back. And I regret not being able to take my daughter into a place like that now. She'll never understand that with the streaming and the digital. And
that is my favorite thing to see when I'm there, because I still stop in. I moved a few hours away, but I still drive over there sometimes and pop in. My favorite thing to see is like a family with a kid, and the kids, because there's still a kid's aisle, which is super eye-catching, and it's got all the brightly colored, you know, movies with talking dogs and all the Harry Potter movies and all that. And just to see a kid that has maybe never, ever experienced a movie as a physical object pick up a movie, and they don't know, and they like instinctively look at the back and it's got something on it that they've never seen before, because they just know it's a thumbnail right on the iPad, and the way the parents light up because they're like, my kid gets it, you know, because most kids will never, if you're under 10 right now, you will probably never be in a video store.
My son is 16 and he'll have friends over and they get so confused sometimes, because all mine's like throughout my whole house. I just have shelves that hug the wall and then we put art above it.
Nice.
His friends get so confused. They've never seen a tape. I have DVDs and Blu-rays. They've only seen Blu-rays. I'm like, what is all this? How do you play this thing? They just hold it.
Yeah, the movie's in there, man.
In a way, we like build museums in our man caves. I mean, that's essentially what I have.
Same.
Was it Ron Funches who mentioned something? I can't remember. Was it Kevin Smith who talked about maybe there could be a resurgence of something like this? Like, you know, you see the retro music shops now where you go in and you look for vinyl. And
I think it was Kevin Smith. Yeah. You see it come and go. I don't know if that's going to happen, because I've been collecting tapes for a little while now and it's not catching on with the normies in the way vinyl did.
You ain't grading your tapes, bud.
I mean, I got some sealed tapes and they're going to be worth a fortune, but no, they're not.
I'm retiring next week.
Yeah. I got those Black Diamond Disney tapes, right? No, it's because the analogy is vinyl, right? Vinyl came back and it's now outselling every other format of music. But there's a reason for that. Vinyl actually sounds better and is a thing. It's a physical experience and you have to be intentional about listening to music and all that. VHS tapes, and I love them, look worse than any other way you can watch that movie, unless it's the only format it's available on. They're super inconvenient. They are constantly degrading.
Chris has a hot take on this.
No, you watch Batman Forever, Batman and Robin, the one with Mr. Freeze, watch that on any format other than VHS. It looks like trash.
Right.
For some films, I think the grainy quality and the blacks are like really what help them. And I'm just being argumentative for no reason.
No, you're 100% right. But the thing about the VHS is, if you don't watch it on a tube TV, if you're not watching it on a CRT, what are you doing?
You can get scalers, but yeah.
Yeah, but then watch it on DVD. Watch it on Blu-ray. Watch it on digital. Watch it on a digital rip of a VHS that's not going to break.
VHS, PS.
It's not better like in the same way vinyl is better. It's cool because it's a physical object, and that's awesome, and I love it. And I love the vibe of watching it on a tube TV, and it feels warm, and you're getting cancer radiation, and that's awesome. But like, it's not convenient, and it's not, but I think there's a reason it's not catching on, and I can still go get tapes for 20 cents, which I love.
Yeah, I don't want it to catch on.
Yeah, because collecting tapes is fun because it's cheap, and because you might find a tape that is worth $100 for a nickel at a yard sale, but you're not going to sell it for $100 because fuck that.
Dude, I had a somebody I worked with, I talk about collecting tapes like an idiot in public, and like, my dentist gave me a whole bunch of cool ones. And
yeah. Then
somebody I work with was like, I got a bunch of those in my basement, brought them in. I was like, these are tight.
Yeah. And that's the fun part. Yeah. I get people all the time. They're like, you're that VHS guy. I wear this hat out in public all the time. People are like, here's a box. And there'll be maybe one tape in there that I didn't already have. Cause everybody has the same 50 tapes, right? It's fun. And it's fun to, I'm a collector by nature. Like I collect all kinds of things. VHS is still affordable and accessible, and you can find them, and it's not like I collected vinyl for a long time, and I feel like I just got priced out of it being fun. It's not fun anymore.
Well, that's what I always find interesting, because I think VHS has already kind of hit the bubble, the high mark, and now it's already coming down, because I see VHSs on eBay already going down in price. Like an exciting time for me, because I'm like, ooh, finally I can, you know, get some certain ones that aren't ridiculous, because there's some in the wild you just won't find. Like I've bought a few. I buy one really nice one on my birthday every year, and ones that I could never find in the wild. And since I have two kids now, going out and hunting in the wild, like a luxury. I don't have time to do it anymore. I think the bubble has gone down. I don't think it will ever be super popular because one, they're cumbersome. They're huge. They take a lot of room to store. And another thing, like Taylor said, for 98% of these, it's the worst quality you can get for the movie. It's not like vinyl where it's just like everyone will sit around and be like, oh, do you hear that earthy tone to this vinyl record? Like no one sits around with a VHS. They're like, oh, I love all these tracking marks everywhere.
Right.
Only idiots like us love that shit.
You remember when I watched Howling 2 for the first thing on here? And I got the copy. There's like a few copies. One of them bright. One of them's so dark you can't see, and then the other one's pretty good. I got the so dark one. They're like, did you see that scene? And I was like, no, I didn't see shit, man. I didn't see shit on this film.
Yeah. Some tapes have, like the tapes I grew up with, will have something unique. Like even if it's just the way they pan and scan on a movie that you can watch in widescreen, you can watch in 4K now probably. But like, it's not going to do that super awkward pan across that I grew up. Like when I watch whatever Forrest Gump, it pans right here. And if you watch it in HD, no, it doesn't. So like there's a nostalgia to the format that outranks the quality. And I think the clearest example of that is like when I pop in the original Ninja Turtles movie, if it doesn't have that Pizza Hut commercial at the beginning, I'm out of here.
I was going to say trailers are my main draw to this.
Trailers.
Movies I forgot existed. And then you get to see new ones. Like I said, I watch a bunch of like weird foreign Japanese stuff. And sometimes I'm like, I don't remember that name of the movie. And then I'll pop something in and the trailer will come on. And I'm like, fuck you.
Yeah, the trailers on those. And they're unique trailers too. It's like the coming soon to VHS. Coming soon to home video. And you're like, some of those aren't even on YouTube, which is wild because YouTube has everything. But it's just so fun. The trailers, the rare time when you'll get a tape out in the wild and get it home and halfway through somebody taped over it with something else. And you're like, this is the greatest moment of my life. It just went to an episode of Seinfeld and I don't know why.
Well, and then those people that just collect like blank tapes or recorded stuff on TV, those huge. I mean, that's a whole subgenre in our genre. That's just like kind of crazy to me.
Yeah. There was an estate sale that had like an entire wall of them. And I was like, I'm not going to buy these and ship them to people. So I just posted in the groups. Nice. Like, you're near. And they're like, can you go get them for me? And I was like, no, I can't. There's thousands of tapes.
Yeah. I can't even imagine what shipping
media mail cost.
Ooh. I know. You love
cheap mail tapes.
It's getting more expensive.
My favorite subgenre of tapes is the instructional tapes that came with like household objects. Like you get a workout machine and it's got the instructions on VHS.
Yeah.
I've got some great ones that are just like for a piece of computer software.
Yes, that's what I was going to say. That dude's like my dad's age and he's like, this was a computer.
You get a floppy disk and also a VHS tape to teach you how to use the floppy disk. And I'm just like, this is everything.
Mine are harder to find, but like that niche for a bit, they were doing video game, like trailers, new car game trailers. Oh man, I am searching for the Magic the Gathering Pro Tour. They released a tape and there was like one for the starter set. I like those. It really hard to find because it was only a couple years they were doing that. And then they stopped.
But you said magic and reminded me of one of my favorite tapes, which is just like a guy teaching you how to do magic tricks. But like,
oh, magic tricks. Cool guy. Yeah. I meant Magic the Gathering.
Oh, I know. And that's, I would love a VHS tape about Magic the Gathering because I play magic. Yeah, the weird stuff. Like, I don't need any more copies of Speed, but if you've got something that's just only exists on VHS that serves to honor the format, that's where, you know, the format holds up. It's like a tape that's about how to work your new VCR. That's the greatest object in the history.
How the fuck do you play it?
Yeah. How did you figure out how to play this?
You don't want one of my 8 copies of True Lies? You don't think those? I'll give you 7.
They're all worn out real heavy on one scene, though.
I don't need it because I've got True Lies on Laserdisc.
Oh, all right. Yeah, there you go. I have 2 questions left for you. And then actually, it's mostly just about one. Who cares about the second one? Because my first question was, how long was your original cut? Because I always wonder that with like a filmmaker, like when they're cutting it.
I don't know specifically per movie because I've done a few now. But usually the first cut comes in between 3 and 5 hours. And I send it to people and I'm like, what would you cut out? And usually they say, like, cut out the part where Lloyd Kaufman is mad at you. And I'm like, nope, that's the only part that's staying in. And we're cutting out all this other stuff.
Not 112 seconds of Lloyd Kaufman.
112 seconds. I'm like, that's...
So my second question is literally right here. So how awkward was Lloyd Kaufman?
What you see in the movie is how it was. No, I love Uncle Lloyd. He is a national treasure. I grew up on Troma. I love... you know, their DIY work ethic, their sort of pathos and the way they interact with the universe by being both wildly offensive and incredibly progressive and just a fascinating case study in how to run a business. I don't know. I was so excited to meet the man. I love Troma. I got to go to his house, which has that concrete toxic bust outside. He had a Blockbuster uniform that someone had given him. I didn't bring that for him. And he was just game and up for anything. And we were chatting and we were having fun. And it was talking about indie film because I'm making an indie film at his house. And he's Lloyd Kaufman. And he's made a ton of indie films. And we're talking about how the evil corporations are ruining the film industry. And the distribution is a scam and all this stuff. Greatest conversation of my life. We hit record and he turns into the evil monster that you see in the movie. Just like he snapped, he turned on the character of cranky Uncle Lloyd, and it was like shocking to me, like, because we had been chatting and being friends for like an hour leading up to hitting record. We hit record and he's basically like, who the fuck are you? Why are you here? I hate Blockbuster. Why would I want to talk about Blockbuster? And we recorded an hour-long interview that was one of the most tense and like argumentative and combative interviews I've ever done. We used about as much as we could in the movie because it's mostly expletives and weird legal accusations against people who, like, I'm not going to do the research and see if Lloyd's right, and I'm not going to accuse someone of some crazy crime in my movie that I can't prove. We used 112 seconds, which was the most we could use. And then we hit stop. And we're best friends again. And he goes and gets a full-size Toxic Avenger poster for me from his attic and signs it, you know, saying, good luck making movies. Your art will be better than Troma. And I'm just like, I don't understand what happened. When the camera's on, we're like mortal enemies. And when the camera's off, we're best friends. So,
yeah, because I don't really see how it's the benefit to him, because he had a chance to really, you know, like kind of just vent on what Blockbuster did to, you know, like Full Moon and Troma films and you know, like those direct-to-video films that I grew up on. Yeah. I was the weird kid who would like try to pretend to be part of the normie world while playing sports and then going home playing D&D and watching, you know, like Troma.
Yeah, yeah.
And yeah. I was living like a two different lives. And it was really funny when one of them would accidentally mix. It was like Seinfeld, but I was like, universes collide, Jerry. You know, it was just like, I could never do it. So like, I just thought he had a great chance to really, you know, kill the character for a moment. And then just tell people, and then you're telling me, you know, it's just like, no, he back to his character and
We're friends. He's in Vampire. Like we're still like, I could text him right now and he'll do me a favor. We're buds. I still love Troma. It was a weird interview. It was yeah. Wild. I don't quite understand. It's like he was doing it on purpose, but like you said, I don't understand what the benefit was. Yeah. For anyone, except it was a very memorable 112 seconds in my documentary.
Well, I can tell you his scene was incredibly funny. Even though you had like an hour long awkward interview, you turned it into like a very good segment where I laughed out loud because I was just like, holy shit, Lloyd Kaufman only got in this for like 112 seconds.
Mm-hmm. And we had to do that. Like we had to call it out. That was our editor, Tim, who was just a genius. He was like, you can't put him in for this brief of time without calling attention to it. Like, it's just weird. Like, he just comes in and rants and then he bounces, right? So it was his idea to be like, what if you put a bumper in that's like, and now 112 seconds with Lloyd Kaufman? I'm like, yeah, that feels right.
They work good.
Yeah. And the intro is like about as long as the bit.
All right. Those are my questions. So, guys, if you got any more, let's get them in before we take up all of Taylor's time.
I got one question. I know this is about Blockbuster, but the real question is a Hollywood video or Blockbuster?
So, I mean, I don't know if this is a video podcast, but behind me is a Hollywood video sign. It's one of my prized possessions that I love very much. I grew up six blocks from a Hollywood video in San Francisco, and I didn't have two nickels to rub together, but I would save, you know, for weeks and weeks and weeks and go and rent a movie or NES game. Super Nintendo, like this was my era, and Hollywood Video was the place that I could ride my bike to or walk to. So for me, Hollywood Video has like the strongest childhood memories. Mm-hmm. And then when I moved up here to Oregon, I was much more of a like the mom and pop store and like mm-hmm. the local place because they had the weird shit. But I was the guy who would go to the weird mom and pop place and rent, you know, a copy of Orgasmo or something, and then still go to Blockbuster because they were, you know, the mom and pop place didn't have The Matrix. They had one copy and it was out. So I was the two video rental stores in the same night guy. I was like, I need my new releases, so I got to go to Blockbuster. But I also want not just, you know, whatever Warner Brothers or Paramount put out this week. If I had to pick one, I mean, I owe a lot to Blockbuster Video at this point in my life.
Yeah.
But I grew up in Hollywood Video, man. It was a weirder vibe. It was weird. Yeah,
that's what I was going to say. So I liked all of them. The mom and pop ones, how I got started in like horror. And for then sure. I was able to drive and Blockbuster was next to where I worked. And then when I moved closer to a Blockbuster and a Hollywood were across the street, Hollywood Ooh. Had the weirder stuff that I was into.
Yeah.
Like, the Stranger mm-hmm. Things, and I started going to Hollywood a lot more. Yeah. I just like the energy there was more like film geeks and people that like music and weirdos worked there. The Blockbuster was like cleaner and nicer that I worked at.
Yeah, and kind of preppy kids worked there, and you're like, I get it, it's fine. You got the polo shirt. I applied to work at Blockbuster many, many times, and I never got past the interview. I don't know what was wrong. Yeah, with
I got
me,
turned down too.
Yeah. They had for a while, they had like the computer kiosk that you would do the interview on or the questionnaire. And I don't know what I was doing wrong. It's some kind of psych evaluation thing, but I never got past that. But for many years I lived across the street from a Blockbuster, and that was when they had their unlimited pass. So I would go and just cycle movies all day. And this was also when you could like rip and burn copies of DVDs. So I was just like building an insane DVD collection go rent a movie, take it home, burn a copy, took 20 minutes, go back, turn that one in, get another movie. And the people who worked there, they knew. They're like, you did not watch that movie. You were here a half an hour ago.
We abused that system. Lived a block away, me and my roommates. Every day. We were getting like four films.
Yeah. It was the best time. And it's also part of why they went out of business.
Yeah. No late fees. That's insane.
Yeah. No late fees. As many movies as you want.
When you went over in the movie, you know, like the no more late fees or, you know, that they had at one time, which I barely remember. Because we also took advantage of the unlimited in college. We were two blocks away. So we just walked there, get whatever we want. It was absurd what they let us do. Like just all the time.
Brief window where they were copying Netflix. So they had discs by mail, but you could return them in the store and get another movie. So you could rent the obscure movies on the internet and it would come in your mailbox and then you can go turn that in for whatever movie you want, unlimited, as fast as you could do it.
Yeah.
It was wild.
Yeah. Not the best business decision by them.
Yeah. I would say another part of the film I really loved was that breakdown, the history of the business and the financials of it too, like the Reed Hastings meeting and then basically the business plan that Blockbuster had and just the financing ran out with the financial crash and all that. And I just eat that stuff up like a kid in a candy store.
I don't love the business financials so much. Like that was a lot longer in the first cut. Like, sorry, Brad, but
Brad loves the Star Wars prequels because of
the procedurals.
Trade negotiations.
Who loves it?
Trade negotiations. Can we cram in? No, I just, you can Google that stuff. It's interesting, I guess, but I just like the drama of just like a bunch of old white guys made a bunch of bad decisions. And then here we are with my friend Sandy shopping at Target. Like, that's the movie I wanted to make, is Sandy shopping at Target and Lloyd Kaufman complaining about Blockbuster. But I know I got a lot of like pushback from people that were like, you didn't have enough of the business, because it is a fascinating case study in how not to run a business. I don't know. I didn't go to business school. I went to art school.
If you want to watch that, make it. You make that movie.
There's YouTube videos, tons of them about like, why did Quiznos go out of business or whatever. You know, it's like, that's a whole genre of YouTube that is great. But like, that is not the same as Kevin Smith talking about the first movie he rented. One of those to me is fun to watch. The other one is like school. Feels like school. That's the problem with it.
Well, the thing is, that's why I like video reviews. Like when I was looking at what I like to do, I love to read just ridiculous reviews. I really do online because I don't care about Rotten Tomatoes and all this. I love to read completely informed, you know, people who have no information about the movie industry, you know, writing reviews like they do. And it's one of my favorite. And one of the first reviews of yours is like, he didn't talk about how much of a failure they were. And it was like that exact, like 5 out of 10. And I was like, wait, you didn't like the movie, but he gave it 5 out of 10. I guess that's good. At least they didn't give 1 out of 10.
It's rough. It's funny. Cause I do these, you know, I did a documentary about ska music and it's all the reviews are by ska fans. And it's like 9 out of 10, whatever, consistent on all the platforms. And then you do Blockbuster and we were at 100% on Rotten Tomatoes for a while. When we put the movie out before it hit Netflix and then millions of people watched it and then millions of people had opinions and it dropped like a stone. A bunch of people like that are like, that's a why is it all white guys with beards talking about video stores? And then I look at our group chat here and it's all white guys with beards who care about video stores. That's why.
Hey, a chick ran it. Okay.
Listen, that's what I kept saying. I'm like, our main character is a woman.
And the narrator
part of the whole movie, and the narrator's a woman. It's like we did the best we could, but also we asked. So that's the other thing with documentaries. We asked exactly as many women as we asked men if they wanted to come talk to us about Blockbuster. And guess who said yes? Bunch of white guys with beards.
Yeah.
Well, you got Ron in it.
It's true. It's true. I love Ron. His laugh is.
Dude, no, he's hilarious. You can hide drugs in here.
You don't have to put your weed in there or whatever you want. Yeah.
Yeah. He's so funny. He's a very calm, funny in a way too. That's what I always love about him.
Yeah.
because I'm not calm at all. So I always find that fascinating when people are like, can stay calm in any situation. You know, like in a business meeting, I'm like, blah, 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 blah. And then I make everyone else feel comfortable because they're like, well, at least I'm not that guy.
You should probably have a podcast.
Yeah, I know. And then drink bourbon during it.
There you go.
Taylor, thanks for coming on. This has been easily one of the best interviews we've ever done because it's just been fun.
It's been my only interview. Thank you.
Hey.
My only interview. Well, I didn't really interview, but.
We usually kick them out.
Okay.
It's not true.
My only Analog Jones and the Temple of Film.
He's like, what is this called again?
I was reading it. It's here in front of me.
Just to remind everyone, you can go to the, vampire.com?
Vampiremovie.com. Yeah. Somebody already clicked vampire.com and wasted it. Damn. That happens all the time.
So vampiremovie.com. He's got the Indiegogo campaign launching on March 4th. So help him out. Help an indie filmmaker out. It'll be great. Are you doing any names at the end of people who donated?
Yeah. We do that on all the crowdfunding things. We stopped doing it at like the low dollar amount because it was too many names. Yeah.
4,000. So
I think it's like if you over $100, you get your name in the credits and on IMDb, but like not for $5 because I can't. It's too much typing. I got carpal tunnel, you know?
You're really small.
Really small.
Hundreds of them.
Yeah. I mean, if you look back at some of my movies, there are hundreds of names in the credits of people who helped us out. And we genuinely appreciate them. And I love that there are hundreds of names in the credits. That's how we make these movies.
There you go. Go out and help them get your name in a movie. It'll be great. Thanks for coming on again, Taylor. This has been fantastic. And go watch The Last Blockbuster. Go donate for the vampire movie. Come on.
We didn't talk much about it, but it's good. It's a lot of fun.
No, I can't recommend it.
Over
our audience probably is, if you haven't seen it already, you know, go out and see it. Go wherever you can find it and get it. And I can't recommend it enough.
It's on Tubi right now.
I loved it. Yeah. Absolutely loved it.
Yep.
I don't know. When we fell off Netflix, it popped up a bunch of places. And I'm like, I don't know where it is. Like, just Google it. It's wherever. I think it's on Crackle. I don't even know what that is.
There's some things I haven't heard of.
Yeah. It's on the internet. You can see it.
All right, everyone. Thanks for listening. And Taylor, thank you again.
Thanks for having me.